This week in the news, we've got the Cruz kickoff, how Republicans are responding to talk of a blue wave, and some hypocrisy by local officials on property taxes. In our interview, we sit down with Austin election lawyer Trey Traynor to discuss an obscure federal election law that could see local candidates go to jail for criticizing President Trump. And finally, in this week's commentary, why you should fear the Mongolian death worm, and it's not what you think. Welcome back to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. This week, we'll get the news started with Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Kerry, you took a trip out to the official general election campaign launch for Senator Ted Cruz running for re-election against Liberal Congressman Beto O'Rourke. Tell us about it a little.
That's right, Tony. Left the People's Republic of Austin, going down to Houston to check out the Redneck Country Club, where U.S. Senator Ted Cruz unveiled his Tough as Texas tour to a packed crowd of supporters down there in Harris County, focusing a lot on his earlier stands against Obamacare, defense of immigration law, and role in Harvey recovery, mainly the highlights of his speech and remarks there. He's doing a tour all across the state right now and kind of going and spreading that message as he campaigns against Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah, and you know, tell us a little bit about O'Rourke. I mean, people are obviously a little less familiar with him.
Right, so, you know, Liberal Congressman Beto O'Rourke, originally Robert Francis O'Rourke, you know, kind of changed his name to try to fit in. You know, represents
Running in West Texas there, you know, basically appealing to the Hispanic vote.
Right, appealing to the Hispanic vote that he actually lost in the Democrat primary, which is a kind of interesting little segue. But O'Rourke, a Democrat congressman from El Paso, you know, changed his name, trying to hide it with a grin to Beto. Robert Francis O'Rourke, you know, somebody who sounds like a pretentious, you know, posh Republican Rockefeller or something.
Guy's running for the Irish vote in Boston.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. You know, running all across the state, bringing in an impressive amount of campaign contributions, but he's not seeming to really gain anything in terms of more grassroots support. You know, a lot of people say if you're going to run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man. And we've seen that time and time again. We haven't had a Democrat win a statewide office here in over two decades.
I mean, going back now, it's 2018. I mean, you're talking about 94?
Yeah, 94. I mean, the last one that I remember is John Sharp as comptroller. Back in the day, and look, I mean, you got to be as tough as Texas. You got to be honest about your plans. You've got to be a conservative leader because liberal thought is not the spirit of a Lone Star Man. We've seen that time and time again. We're seeing conservatives rally and take new majorities in the Texas House, new majorities in Congress. You know, I don't think that millions of Texans are going to vote for someone who wants open borders and wants to take our guns, Tony.
Yeah, no, I agree. So what was the reaction from folks there at the Redneck Country Club, you know, at the event?
It was a rowdy event. There were a lot of excited folks. There were a lot of elected officials there. We saw multiple members of the SREC, state representatives, conservative leaders. I think people were rallied. I think people were united behind Ted Cruz. In the general election, I think they were united behind him in the primary. He got like 80-something percent of the vote, only minimal opposition. I think he's cruising to victory, as the campaign used to say, and it's not going to be a tough deal at all, except for the fact that Beto O'Rourke is currently out-fundraising Ted Cruz, which is a cause of concern here in the state of Texas.
Yeah, and you know, obviously Cruz has to get his message out there, has to inspire people, and remind them what they were excited about, and remind them, you know, that he has actually delivered on what he said he would do when he was running for the Senate, you know, wow, 6 years ago.
Right, Tony. I think it's interesting for us to remember when conservatives run for office, they don't promise pork. They don't promise even results. They promise to fight. They promise to come back with either the trophies of victory or blood on their knuckles from being in the trenches and in the fight. You saw Ted Cruz in the government shutdown. You've seen him here on immigration. You've seen him trying to repeal Obamacare, everything. It's hard to say that Ted Cruz has been absent for the fight. In fact, he's been the biggest conservative leader in the U.S. Senate.
Absolutely.
Somebody who's actually been representing Texas very well, and that's why you saw Michael Berry, the you know conservative czar of talk radio in Houston, introducing him. It was at his Redneck Country Club.
Yeah.
A lot of rowdy people excited about Ted Cruz and proud that he's their U.S. senator.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to follow it. Obviously, the liberal media wants to make O'Rourke out to be some savior for the Democratic Party, but I'm pretty skeptical, and it seems you're pretty skeptical as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's not going to be able to pull in the cash, and it's not going to work. The only interesting thing is going to be what percent of the vote he loses by.
Yeah. Well, appreciate that report, Kerry. Thanks for joining us and telling us a little bit about it.
Thanks, Tony.
Next, let me pull in Brandon Waltons, Capitol Bureau Chief with Texas Scorecard. Brandon, you know, I want to talk to you about this issue of Republican Party fundraising. Obviously, there's lots of news out there, a lot of people saying, oh, man, it's going to be this blue wave. Democrats are going to come in and win all these elections in Texas. They're going to turn Texas blue or purple or something like that. But kind of news to the contrary, you're seeing the Republican Party with some record fundraising.
Exactly. So last month, in the month of March, a month there, but where both parties had their primary elections, Republicans outvoted Democrats in those primary elections. The Republican Party of Texas announced that they had actually shattered a five-year fundraising record, raising just over $244,000by the 28th of the month. Some more came in, obviously, after that. We haven't seen those numbers, but very bad news for Democrats who are kind of looking at the current electoral landscape and thinking that maybe they have an opportunity in November. It's going to be really tough with this kind of fundraising.
Well, and they haven't, you know, won in decades. But, you know, one of the things that I don't think people really understand is, like, what is it that the party does? I mean, they think of the party as a label for, you know, okay, Polly Somi runs, this is the elephant party. We put an R next to the name. You know, this is the Democrat donkey party. We put the D next to the name. But these are actually grassroots organizations that serve some important functions, both with regard to elections and in terms of politics.
Exactly. And so, of course, you've got statewide and November general election sort of efforts that are run by the party campaigning for the Republican candidates.
Yeah, the victory effort where they're basically working up and down the ballot saying, hey, can we get Republicans out?
One of the bigger things that the party spends money on is every 2 years, of course, there is the convention, which is being held in San Antonio this year.
Yeah. One of the issues going into the convention is Chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, James Dickey, running for re-election. He was elected by the state Republican Executive Committee in the interim and getting a challenge, Cindy Ash of Frisco running against him. And, you know, one of the issues, I remember this, is kind of every time there's a serious challenge to a party chairman, and I'm thinking back to the days when Kathy Adams was elected in the interim and then defeated by Steve Munisteri going back, I think this was 2010. Mm-hmm. I was there, but I think it was 2010, 8 years ago. You know, one of the big issues that people cared about was, is the party in a healthy financial condition?
Right.
And I think that you'd heard a little bit of buzz going on out there of saying, oh, man, the party's in bad, dire financial straits. This seems to be a bit of an answer to that.
Exactly. It always seems to be an argument made by the insurgents, and especially those who don't like Chair Dickey right now. It tends to be moderate establishment members of the Republican Party. It sort of takes that argument off the table for them.
Yeah, and so they'll have to, you know, maybe they have to campaign on the issues, which may not be very good for them. Right. Well, I appreciate the reporting on it. Thanks for covering this, and thanks for joining me, Brandon.
Thank you.
Next up, I've got Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau for Texas Scorecard. Got a great article up recently at texasscorecard.com about some local officials here in Central Texas who are raising taxes, and then they want to point the blame elsewhere. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, exactly. Well, people here in Austin and everywhere across Texas are upset that their taxes are going up.
Absolutely.
And so they come to Mayor Adler here in Austin, and they're like, hey, why are our taxes going up? Mayor Adler says, well, blame the state. Blame Robin Hood, which is the part of the state's school finance system.
So here's a mayor who's responsible for city taxes.
Right.
But he's pointing the finger and saying, hey, this scheme that affects school taxes and how school taxes are redistributed, that's to blame. That's why your city taxes are so high. It's kind of didn't really follow.
Right. He wants to blame the state for all the tax increases, but yet his own city is increasing taxes, which is a totally separate thing.
And engaging in redistribution like the Robin Hood. Well, let's talk about the Robin Hood plan real quick so people know what this is. A plan adopted in the early 90s, and it basically says, look, we're going to go in, we're going to change the way the school property tax, the M&O tax, is done statewide. Normally in the past, you would have taxed and that money would have gone to your local school. But now we're going to have a local tax. It's going to be, because you can't have a statewide property tax. We're going to have a local tax. And then everybody's going to kind of send their accounts to the state, and the state's going to look at it, and then they're going to come in Robin Hood, steal from the rich, give to the poor. Right? We're going to take from districts that have property,
right,
and we're going to redistribute that money to some other district. And so you literally have money coming out of the pockets of taxpayers in one corner of the state going to some school in another corner of the state.
Right. Every city pays into this big pool of money that the state redistributes everywhere.
Every school district.
Every school district. And but the wealthier ones have to pay more.
But the funny thing is, this is, as you were saying, this is exactly what the city of Austin, very liberal city council, they're voting for tax increases and then taking the money and passing
they're
it around
the same
from
practices.
Taking from the wealthier people and giving them to the poorer people, doing the exact same thing they accuse the state of doing.
Exactly. I mean, imagine a quick scenario. If I came up to you and said, hey, Tony, I saw you sneaking money from people. I saw you sneaking money out of their wallets, and that's really wrong, and you need to return that money. But yet, what would you think of me if I turned around and then went and robbed a bank?
It's a little bit of hypocrisy there. Yeah. So this is something that's you know, relevant. It's not just an Austin story. I mean, this is something that's relevant to taxpayers all over the state. You know, there's all these various entities that they pay taxes to, their county, their city, their school district. And while it's true with the schools, some portion of that tax might be, you know, grabbed up and taken and given to some other corner of the state. You know, the cities, they make their own decisions about these things.
Right. Well, the mayor's certainly right to criticize Robin Hood because it's wealth redistribution, and it's wrong. But what the mayor can control, his own city's tax policy, he's still taking more of his residents' money.
Yeah. No, I appreciate your coverage of this. This is something that taxpayers need to, you know, be able to look through the rhetoric and deal in the reality and point these kind of things out. So I appreciate you helping them do that.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome on the program this week Trey Traynor, an Austin election lawyer, guy we've worked with over the years, and recently nominated by President Trump to the Federal Elections Commission, awaiting confirmation hearings. That Washington moves somewhat slowly, but waiting for those hearings. But I wanted to bring in Trey to talk about a story I saw last week, something out of the Institute for Free Speech saying that local candidates running for state and local offices, could be in like serious violation of federal election law if they either criticize or praise President Trump on the campaign trail. Can you tell me a little bit, like, what? How could that be? Because you see it all over the place. How could that be?
Well, thanks for having me on, Tony. And that's right. We've seen two recent decisions out of the Federal Elections Commission which show that state-level candidates using President Trump's name in various political activity for state offices have run afoul of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this as we move through this midterm election cycle. There's 36 state governorships up on the ballots across the country in November. There's well over 6,000 state legislative seats up. Here in Texas, you're looking at 15, 16 state Senate seats, all of the House of Representatives, Lieutenant Governor, Governor
Tons
Abbott.
Of elections. And you just see this all over. I mean, you think about your typical Democratic campaign. What are they, you know, they're campaigning right now on, hey, come out and support the Democrats because we're going to fight Trump. It's, you know, show up in November so that we can defeat Trump and defeat Trump's agenda.
Right.
That's
That's the number one thing I see people talking about on the campaign trail.
And it is obviously a very motivating factor for folks on the left that the president's in office right now. And in fact, one of the decisions by the Federal Elections Commission had to do with the Washington State Governor, Jay Inslee, ran an ad that was basically, it was a TV ad that said, you know, come out and oppose Trump. And the federal
This was back in 2016. So during the presidential election, and he's on the, you know, Trump's on the ballot, Clinton's on the ballot, and he's saying, hey, look, come out. You know, he wants people to vote for him.
Right.
But he's saying, how is he going to get people to vote for him? Well, he's telling people to vote for against Trump.
Obviously, you know, federal candidates have a tendency to be a shorthand for positions that people hold, policy positions that they hold. And the governor in Washington decided that it was better to have people come out and vote against Trump than vote for Hillary. And so he used that in the TV ad and pushed it. And now the Federal Elections Commission has said, well, because the state of Washington has campaign limits that are in excess of the federal limits, that the use of that shorthand oppose Trump becomes an expenditure under federal law and running afoul of BCRA.
Yeah,
and we saw the same thing. The other one was
This one goes the other way, right? So this is a Republican. Missouri?
In Missouri, and there it was a mail piece urging Missourians to come out and support the gubernatorial candidate and support Trump. So it was basically linking the Republican to Trump in that situation. Again, a shorthand, and what every candidate at the state level is looking for with a federal candidate like President Trump or Secretary Clinton is they're looking for some sort of coattails effect.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of money spent in federal elections, definitely a lot of money spent in presidential elections, and they're using part of that name recognition to identify themselves with one side or the other. And when you have space at such a premium, both airtime or mail pieces, you can only do so much. You want to motivate voters as much as you can. And if that shorthand of talking about the federal candidate or associating yourself with or against the federal candidate is there, that's what people are doing. And I think you're going to see more of it. And what we see now is the potential that, I think what you see is potential constitutional challenges as to whether or not BCRA can go so far as to regulate what a state-level candidate is saying in a state-level legislative or gubernatorial race.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that here in a second. I mean, it is really interesting. You basically have the turnout in a presidential year election, you know, maybe close to double the turnout that you see in a midterm congressional election. And so you have all of these folks showing up. Well, why are they showing up in that election and not the other one? Well, okay, maybe there's a governor's race, or maybe there's some special circumstance, but largely it's because they're voting for president.
Sure.
they're voting at the top of the ticket. And so, you know, it's obviously understandable if you know, one in two or one in three of your voters are showing up for this single purpose, you're going to say, hey, I'm on Team Trump, or I'm on Team Not Trump, right?
You know,
as a motivating factor. So really interesting there. I was surprised as I saw the article. I think it ran on the Hill, I posted a little piece about it for Texas Scorecard. As I looked at it, this has actually been before the Supreme Court, this provision of BCRA. So let's talk a little bit about the history there with what's called BCRA, Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and, what was adopted there, and then the fact that this provision, mind-blowingly, has actually been touched on by the Supreme Court.
Sure. Well, in 2003, the Supreme Court did uphold this rule, saying that state-level candidates can't have this level of discussion of federal candidates when they're using funds raised in excess of federal limits. Now, where I think that changes is in 2010 in Citizens United. I mean, there are provisions in BCRA that have been struck down in that decision that say that there are people who under BCRA aren't allowed to speak. Well, the Supreme Court's gone in a different direction and say, well, yes, they are.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that you're going to start to see, especially if the FEC sees an increase in the number of state-level candidates who are brought in front of the FEC to deal with state-level campaigns. I think you're going to see more and more challenges to whether or not this rule can stand up.
Yeah, basically, so you have this law passed. This is McCain-Feingold, right?
It is. That's the shorthand that everybody understands.
People know McCain-Feingold. This is the thing that was passed. And basically what, you know, I'm very critical of these attempts that have gone on is you basically had Washington, you know, legislators, senators, representatives saying, look, we want to try to decrease the amount of spending in elections. And that some people think that sounds good, but what it ends up meaning is we want to chill people from speaking, right? We want to try and limit the net total amount of speech. And so they set up these rules and they say, okay, you can only give so much to this candidate and these other entities can only spend so much and you can only do X, Y, and Z. And what you end up with is kind of this game of whack-a-mole, right? You knock one mole down on one hand, and another he pops up over here, and so you whack that one down. And apparently the logic behind this was, well, what we're going to see is people just funneling money into state campaigns. They're going to run some schlub for governor of swing state number two, and he's not really going to have any shot of winning his race. But we're, you know, you see people give him lots of money to run for governor or run for congressman or run for whatever, and he's going to use all that money really just as a little shell group to support some federal candidate. Have we seen anything, you know, like that actually play out?
You haven't. I mean, again, especially in these two cases that the FEC has decided, I mean, the effort was done to elect the state-level candidate, the gubernatorial candidate, is where the primary focus was. Again, it was just a shorthand to try to get the coattails of whatever was available from those two candidates. And if you look at BCRA, it forced a lot of the spending. I mean, the state parties became the most important entities in political power under BCRA, because that's where a lot of this spending can go on. And state-level parties engage in this. I mean, here in Texas, I know on the Republican side, you have the Republican Victory Effort. And there, they will put out complete slates of from federal candidates all the way down, where you have both state and federal candidates appearing on mail pieces that are sent out by the Republican Party. And that's where BCRA envisioned that the funds would go. And they have largely gone there, but again, bleeding off of the coattails effect from that. If the state party has put out an effort of vote for all of these Republicans, and here's a picture of everybody from the U.S. congressman all the way down to who's running for justice of the peace, you know, the guy that's running for justice of the peace loves that mail piece and gets the idea of, I want to associate myself with the federal candidate too, because he's running a bunch of TV ads. And so I think that's where you've seen this growth happen and where the push has come to have this type of spending.
Well, and so there, you know, but because of this law, which, you know, has been upheld, you have state and local candidates who, and this is specific to just these candidates. They actually, you know, it's oddly specific to the candidates themselves. Right. So, you know, groups and PACs and others, you know, they can do these things. The party can do these things. But the candidate themselves, they come out and say, come vote for me. Let's go defeat Trump this November.
Right.
Is kind of plainly violating the letter of the law. It's just kind of bizarre.
Right. No. And again, I think there will be a real push, especially after these two decisions, to go forward and let the court system outside of the FEC take a look at it.
Yeah, and so what we saw in 2010, many people malign the Citizens United decision, but you know, really going down and saying, look, free speech overrides all of these, I mean, many of these regulations on campaign spending.
Sure.
And you saw the ruling that says, look, corporations can go out and engage in independent political speech. And when people think of corporations, they think Walmart or whatever, but you're also the PTA, the local garden club, what have you. They're a corporation, a body, an entity.
Sure. You know, being in Texas, it's, you know, I often tell people, so the first actual corporate expenditure that happened after Citizens United actually happened in Texas in a race in East Texas that had to do, it was actually, if I remember correctly, and I might get this wrong, so please forgive me, but it's if I remember correctly, it was a local liquor store, and the issue, and I want to say it was an issue of a wet dry type election. And interestingly enough, it was the liquor store that was already in the wet area that was opposing the wet dry area because it was going to hurt business.
Yeah, they're campaigning. they didn't want any competition.
Right.
The precinct line liquor store does not want the precinct over to change to a wet precinct.
Right. So I remember right after Citizens United seeing that and thinking, well, this is probably not what the Supreme Court thought would happen, is that it'd have a massive effect on wet dry election in the state of Texas. But that's where we first saw it.
That's kind of where you first saw it pop up. But it's interesting. So the ruling there kind of freed and opened up a lot of activity with regard to elections by groups of people.
Oh, sure.
But then you still have this provision here that says, look, as a candidate for office, you just flat out, straight up can't talk about these federal officials in your campaign.
So what you've seen is that you've opened up political speech for corporations and other entities to speak, and now you have very much recognized in these two decisions a limitation on state level candidates, and so we have one group of people that's not allowed to talk about federal candidates, and everybody else is allowed to talk, from the state party to local businesses to advocacy organizations across the board. And here you have one carve out of one group of people that's not allowed to speak. And I think that ultimately the concern here was, is there going to be a funneling of large amounts of cash to try to run federal elections in there? And I think there's still very much a personal interest that's going to always be the bias against that.
Yeah,
the
right.
governor in Washington is not going to turn over the campaign and allow the Clinton campaign to run it.
Even the candidate for dog catcher is always, his interest is always going to be front. Center, yes. But
mention my name first, then mention Trump. My name first, then mention Hillary. You're always going to have it in that order when the candidate's making that decision.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, there's something I think we'll have to keep an eye on. I appreciate you coming on, Trey. Appreciate your expertise. Very clear why the president wants you for the FEC because of your knowledge and expertise on all of these issues. And just appreciate you coming and sharing a little bit of that with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Next up, did you know you paid for the Mongolian death worm? Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more in this week's commentary.
Texas taxpayers paid for a Mongolian death worm. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. Texas taxpayers pay for a lot of things the normal person wouldn't think government should be buying. And at the top of that list would be paying for a Mongolian death worm. Confused? Yeah, you probably should be. You see, the Mongolian death worm isn't some scary monster. It was a grade B made-for-TV sci-fi movie that no one saw. But your tax dollars paid for it. As it turns out, nearly $100 million have been paid out in subsidies to major corporations to fund projects like the Mongolian death worm movie and even TV commercials. Advocates for the Hollywood handouts claim subsidies bring in new jobs. But that's not what studies show. Both the Texas Comptroller and the Wall Street Journal have found subsidies for film and television to be economically wasteful, at best producing temporary jobs. That's why many states have begun eliminating their Hollywood subsidies. But Texas has not. An independent and in-depth empirical study by the Massachusetts Department of Revenue in 2008 found that their state lost $88,000 in tax revenue for every job created by the Commonwealth's film tax credit. Meanwhile, the Florida Office of Economic Demographic Research also discovered that the state's incentives were temporary and included many out-of-state fly-ins. We still have our Hollywood subsidy going in Texas, despite conservatives trying to rid us of it. For several legislative sessions running, attempts have been made to shut down this wasteful form of corporate welfare. Rather than give the film industry special carve-outs, Texas lawmakers should instead consider policies that put everyone on equal footing. Cut taxes, cut regulations. After all, Texas didn't become a bastion of economic freedom and prosperity by repeating the mistakes of New York, California, and Louisiana. Texas lawmakers should rid the Lone Star State of corporate welfare, and ending the Hollywood film subsidy is a good place to start. In the Lone Star State, we don't need to subsidize starlets, we need to expand freedom. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Well, you know, Michael's right, and that's exactly what Jacob and I were talking about earlier. We've got too much political rhetoric out there defending moving money from one pocket and putting it in somebody else's pocket, and that's the real problem. Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening, and come back next week. Until then, subscribe on iTunes and check us out on Facebook and Twitter.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.